You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. We're entering our second hour with Peter Joseph, the creator of Zeitgeist Addendum. So, Peter, can we pick up where the break interrupted you in mid-thought?
Sure. Yes, we were discussing the emergent nature of reality, and the comment I was going to make was that in regard to belief systems, the only way a belief system, in my mind, can be valid is if it allows, built into the belief system, for that particular worldview to be completely eradicated. In other words, there's a certain paradox that we're constantly living in. I mean, our language perpetuates this, too. Every time I say a sentence, it sounds very declaratory, but our language, of course, is subject to tremendous interpretation through semantics, and then if you take a word and define it, it goes to infinity because all words are defined by other words. So there's this colossal illusion that exists as far as what we think is static understanding, and in reality, the fact is it doesn't exist. So even everything I'm saying right now, I allow for it to be eventually disproven, and I welcome it because it elevates to a new level. It elevates me, it elevates understanding to a new level. Therefore, when you realize that everything is cumulative and culminating, such as, remember, Isaac Newton once stated that he achieved what he did because he stood on the shoulders of giants. And his point is that it's all a continuous running culmination. And to think that anyone should have ego, for example, is one of the biggest abominations. There's absolutely no disposition for someone to take pride in what they understand because they're refusing to recognize that what they understand easily and has been dictated through time will eventually be updated or adjusted or completely eradicated. When Isaac Newton created the theory of gravity, you know, gravity, of course, is extremely tangible. We think, well, this is, you know, we can predict the planetary orbits, and then Einstein came along and adjusted it. He made slight variations on it, which made it even more authentic. And this type of adjusting is going to happen perpetually. We're always going to grow. We're always going to learn. We're always going to change. And I think if people really understand that, the religious community, of course, is the first to completely reject this because they have a fixed worldview. They think they know this and that. And I mean establishment religion. Religion's a very loose word. And they're dogmatic. They have one reference book. They don't update it. They don't adapt. They're forced to adapt in certain weird biosocial influences with biosocial influences. For example, you know, they used to refer to the beast of burden in the Bible as the proof that you should have slaves. And obviously they readjusted their interpretation of that, the Vatican did. So now, you know, slavery is eradicated. So now it says that the Bible is against slavery, which, you know, they just keep making stuff up to readapt the semantical interpretation to society. So the very basis, though, is utterly dogmatic, and we have to move away from this if we expect to have any sustainability in society itself or our personal development. As far as I'm concerned, society today is paralyzed, and in the words of Fritz Perls, the human species is the only species on the planet that has the ability to interfere with its own growth, and I think that's a very important thing to think about.
So on some level, you're analyzing the nature of the human being in group context and in the individual potentiality, if that's a word.
Sure.
Because it seems like the group that we have found, we're born into a group. I mean, there's nothing we can do about it. We have a family or, you know, if we're a wild child and we're abandoned in the forest and we end up like a Tarzan, then we're kind of really on our own. And there are people that have been studied. Sociologists go nuts when a wild child emerges because there are so many things that they can determine are whether they're environmental or innate in development. Now, why do we have another break so fast? We'll have to come back in 3 minutes.
Okay.
With Peter Joseph.
Thank you.
You're listening to republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and I am smack in the middle of a discussion with Peter Joseph, the creator of Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, I was saying before the break, we are born into a group, and we are kind of raised to see our lives as a series of things that we have to do, things we have to adapt to. And as you mentioned, I think it was the Krishnamurti quote in the beginning that he says, we're adapting to essentially a sick society, and we're trained, and everything in everyone's power is done to acclimate us to that surrounding sickness, which nobody really recognizes as such.
Right.
So you are talking about, it seems to me, the essential kernel of what makes a person, and that there's a very expansive nature to the individual human being that doesn't exist in the group. So you are proposing that the group adapt itself more to the fluid, expansive nature of the individual, I think.
Well, I think obviously the group mentality has to have its origins in some level in psychology. So the sociology has its basis in psychology, yet the psychology is heavily influenced by sociology, so to speak, to put it very generally. I think that, you know, they kind of work hand in hand. To put it a different kind of a different way, the social system that we have is in one way a reflection of our personal psychology and our development, at least to a certain degree. I think now it's very paralyzed and we're actually moving backwards. But then again, the social system has an incredible influence on the way people behave. So there's, for lack of a better expression, there's sort of a chicken and egg type thing that's happening here. And I couldn't tell you which is more prevalent. Obviously, if you want to change the system, the change has to first occur in a few people, and then it has to catch on in society. So I guess the individual psychology is very important. But then again, all of the things that comprise us as human beings, at least 90% is our experience based on society. So we're really running culminations of experience. I believe that our individuality, or whatever you want to call it, is really nothing more than the set of conditions that we have been brought out of. A lot of people hearing that will think that's a very cold view, but I don't think it is. I think it's a very beautiful reality when you realize how interconnected we really are symbiotically, that we are expressions of nature itself. We are individual creative expressions of our own unique experience of nature itself. And rather than, you know, have these kind of metaphysical notions that many people have about life and reality or religion to try and find meaning in their lives, I think if people start thinking about their relationship to nature truly and not dismissing it as boring and cold science as far as the interrelationship, which many people do in this romanticized worldview that they try to perpetuate, and see it for what it really is and how beautiful it actually really is, to see how connected we really are to each other and nature, how influence spreads, you know, just like a natural, almost like a natural law. It's like we influence each other. We're constantly shaping behavior all the time. For example, to change the subject slightly, but still within the same context, if you run into somebody that has problems and you help them out, as opposed to, say, abusing them or manipulating them, two different, very different things are being implanted in that particular person. If you go up to somebody that's in a weak position and you take advantage of them, which is very common in our society, whether it's a business type thing, you know, if a company is going bankrupt and then, you know, they're absorbed by some other company, or you see a person on the street that has something really nice that they have to sell because they're poor, and rather than you giving them what you think the real value would be, you take advantage of their disposition and you give them virtually nothing because you know how desperate they are. What you do when you do that, and this is the basis of our society, is you're implanting the seed that this is the way life is, and this is what you have to do, sir, to go out and survive. You have to take advantage of everybody else. However, if the reverse was true, for example, if people went up to each other and were extremely positive, and they gave money to homeless people, they went and helped people without reward, this sets up an entirely different disposition that communicates something that's extremely positive. For if you give money to somebody and you don't need anything in return, while they might initially feel, depending on their conditioning, that they're taking advantage of the situation, they're getting one up on you, what might happen is they start to say, wait a minute, this person's actually reaching out and giving me this, And I don't have to do anything, nor do I, you know, I don't have to do any type of subservience. It's actually a gift, and it's a form of help. It's a communal type of relationship, and that plants a seed. And this is very important, I think. Every moment of our lives, we are affecting the behavior of society. And if you choose to reverse it and get into a giving mentality as opposed to a taking, then you yourself will plant a seed. Every time you give to something, every time you give to another person, every time you help somebody without reward, you're giving them the courage to do the same with somebody else. And this is the real secret to how this type of transition, this type of change can happen in society, where we get out of this domineering type of manipulation. Because in the end, it's always self-preserving in the long run. For example, if there's a homeless person on the street and I see that they might have a criminal propensity, they're starving, if I help them, that reduces the probability of them moving into criminal behavior because of their environment, what their environment needs.
Well, Peter, let me ask you this. Doesn't religion teach, organized religion, which is kind of thing that you pummel so much in your film, but doesn't it teach doing that, giving out of kindness and helping?
Sure.
And then when you also you refer to homeless people on the street, to me it seems like the homeless person has emerged from this very flawed system that
Definitely.
We have.
Definitely.
So you're proposing ways to correct the system, kind of jumping into the middle of it and starting there. But
well, I'm making a general example as far as my prior argument that was actually less of a holistic approach. It was more of a general human behavior type thing, the way we think about our interactions with each other and the way we engage each other as friends or strangers. And my whole point, just to summarize that, was the more you give to society, the more you get in return, because you're securing society when you help. But if you take all the time, you're destabilizing society. And that was my central point. As far as religion is concerned, yes, there's some beautiful things in religion that philosophically are right on target and speak to the human condition by all means. But it's been completely outbalanced by all the other unbelievably dogmatic, corrupt, violent things. In every single religious text, there's incredibly violent elements, which makes sense because these texts were written in periods of time where this type of stuff was a hardcore reality due to, again, scarcity to many extremes. So war, you know, God, the image of God in like the Old Testament is this angry man who creates floods. And what it is, it's not the image of God, it's the image of man, because man created this thing that they thought was real, and they made it in their image because that's all they knew. So I agree with you. I think that the notions of, and Fresco, in fact, has said this on many occasions, not being a religious man, but he says, you know, if people really believe in the actual positive teachings of Christ, then, you know, they would automatically like this idea, because this is all about people helping each other. It's not about differential advantage. It's about, you know, it's not competition. And I think that's a very, very good point. And I hope that the religious community recognizes that. And I don't pummel religion in as far as people. I'm going after the ideology itself and the social systems that have been created by this, and, of course, the historical relevance as far as the first zeitgeist, things that people should really start to reflect if they want to believe that these stories are true. So I know that people think I attack religion, and they take that personally as though I'm attacking them. And I want to make that very clear. I see no difference in any human being I ever meet. It could be a born-again Christian or a serial killer. What I see are two victims of an aberrant culture. I don't see a bad or negative person. There's no such thing. I see two different culminations of life experience, and there's no judgment in that. And will I behave differently with each one on a certain level, depending on how distorted one's worldview might be? Of course, but at the very core, I see no difference between any human being at all. There's no such thing as a bad person, and there never was.
Now, Peter, one of the things in your film that impressed me was this statement, we've gone from alchemy to chemistry. And I think that, for instance, organized religion, it operates on principles that are very beautiful, as you said. They're like alchemical, but it breaks down because of the way that it is organized into this chemistry, this very low-level, linear, it's like a degeneration of what it was intended to be in the first place, ostensibly.
Perhaps.
So, I don't know, I don't think we're hearing break music, but there seems to be a little disturbance on the line. I think that the reactions you've gotten from all these people, I don't know where they find the New World Order thesis strung through your film. That I can't see at all. But this is some of what's being said.
Sure, sure. Well, I can see the general thread. Just as when you speak of anything outside of the free enterprise system, everyone immediately thinks communism, or they think collectivism or socialism. And simultaneously, within this kind of conspiracy world that, you know, we're all kind of paying attention to, where we are aware of these powerful groups that seek hegemonic control, and hence the age-old adage of the New World Order and full, you know, financial domination of the planet and serfdom and all that stuff. And people take it much farther now. You have people talking about eugenics operations and stuff like that. I pay little attention to that at this point. The fact that I mentioned world unification is essentially what triggers this. And the fact that I mentioned a different form of society is another one. And people are terrified of change in this system, even though they don't realize how bad the system is in and of itself. So, you know, there's been radio talk show hosts that I think of their own self-preservation have been threatened by my attempt to communicate something new. And I believe it's a propaganda campaign more than anything else. And that's really all it could be, because if you really look at what I'm stating and what Jacques stating, it has absolutely nothing to do with any type of elitism or anything like that. It's the complete opposite.
Well, we are into our next little 3-minute break, and we'll be back on the other side.
Okay.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and my guest today is Peter Joseph, creator of the new film Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, one of the lines, I've been highlighting certain things in my notes during the break. I wanted you to explain, all borrowed money is an illegitimate form of consideration and therefore voids the contract.
Right. There was basically, in a legal contract, you have this term consideration, which basically represents property. So if you and I were to have a contract together, each one of us has to have something to represent real value that's tangible to be used for the exchange. So when someone takes a mortgage contract, the house that exists is that consideration, because it can be taken away, or the contract can be nullified, and someone loses the house if they can't pay their loan. Simultaneously, the bank, which gives the loan, does not have a legitimate form of consideration, because it's not real. Because of the bank processes, they make money literally out of thin air on computer screens now, based on a variable reserve rate, which essentially means that they have a certain number of deposits. They have X number of deposits, and this allows for X number of loans. But this is actually a fallacy. The deposit scheme is also known as the reserve ratio, and this is also related to the Federal Reserve Bank. I don't want to go into too much detail about the specifics, but let it be stated that there's no such thing as the reserve. It's totally fictional, because any bank can go up to the Fed and get more money from them, more fake money to use as reserves anytime they want, through, I believe, the discount window. So basically what it is a bank, when they loan you money, they're not loaning you anything of their own accord. They have little ledger line things that they write in, basically, and that's it. It's fictional. So there's no real money given to you. It's not like someone goes into a bank and deposits their money, and then the bank takes that money and loans it out to you. That would be legitimate consideration. That's not what happens. So in the film, I have a man named Jerome Daly who had a court case in the 1960s. As far as I know, he's only maybe two or three other people have had this type of success, but he was able to get the jury to understand. And I believe he was a lawyer, and he was very versed. He was very much against the Fed. He knew exactly what he was doing. And he made the jury understand that the bank, which was trying to foreclose on his property, never had the money to begin with that was loaned to him, therefore voiding the contract to repay. And granted, it's a very far-fetched sounding thing, But it is a legal, a legitimate legal basis. When you take money from a credit card, they're making the money out of thin air right on the spot for you to take. And their liability is literally only statistical and on a ledger. So when a bank goes bankrupt, granted people will lose their jobs, but the money is still fiction, and it's not real, and it never was. And that's
right.
The point.
And what I was after in asking you to explain it was, how do we employ that concept in our real lives, that we are entering into a contract that is void from its inception?
Sure.
Should we not enter into this kind of contract, or does it give us the opportunity to walk out on the contract without being scathed because of the fallacy of the whole contract to begin with?
Well, just like the income tax, the whole system is rigged, and it's set up to benefit the state. So I couldn't give you advice one way or another. I make that point in the film simply because it's important for people to think that way. And honestly, if someone wants to challenge, say all the foreclosures that are happening right now, I'd love to see someone, you know, take this to the Supreme Court. But I don't think it ever would materialize past, you know, regional courts, mainly because you're dealing with the entire banking system. And unless you have, like, a class action of millions of people, which I hope could happen, this type of thing would be completely ignored. Anybody who presents it now would be looked at as a lunatic. He'd be thrown out of court. I think everyone that's tried to do it in the modern day has been laughed at, even though it is legitimately sound. You have to remember that the entire legal institution is a complete fraud, too. It's based on semantic interpretation. That's why the IRS code is, you know, 800 pages long, because they know that with all the jargon and all the nonsense that no one is going to be able to weed through, at least very few, weed through to figure out that there's no real law. And that they claim that essentially the statute book is the law in a very twisted way. But, you know, this is the type of thing that they do. So the legal enterprise will defend the system and can twist everything around, and they could eventually decide that it is consideration if they really wanted to. These are just definable terms that they can, at their own whim, just like they redefine torture, the legal community, in the future the legal community will be considered criminal. Because the whole basis is manipulation. You can't expect, you know, equal justice under the law. That is one of the most ridiculous things. And you have a system of legal counterpoint where there's no real interest to preserve or do something correctly. A lawyer for a criminal is going to do everything he can to benefit the criminal. And that's just the game. That's the way it is. It doesn't matter what the lawyer actually feels, because that's not his role. It's not his job. He's there to defend regardless. So the whole idea of ethics and law, and back to my original larger point, you know, the main court appointed judges are never, ever going to allow this to come to fruition if that was the case. But it's very good for people to make aware of it. I say people are, you know, this is the game we live in. You have to get a mortgage. You have to do what you have to do unless you have all the money to pay for it. So I present that as a poetic note in a lot of ways, but it is very tangible. And if, you know, if someone's motivated to do it on their own accord to make an example, they should definitely do it.
Well, we're on to our next 3-minute break, and we'll be back for our last half hour with Peter Joseph.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
You're listening to RepublicBroadcasting.org, the RBN Network. This is Sophia, your host, and we are in our last half hour with Peter Joseph, creator of Zeitgeist Addendum. Peter, I want to devote this last half hour to the Venus Project, and I want to bring in another thing that I wrote down in my notes from your film, and then you can lead into how you've discovered Venus Project and so forth. The most important issue at hand is the intelligent management of the Earth's resources. So I underlined the word management, and I said to myself, okay, here's a word that I have a problem with. Who's going to manage? Because that immediately implies somebody's going to control or take care of, right?
Well, sure, you can look at it that way. Well, first let's step farther back and think about the relevance of the resources and what they contribute to society. Obviously, everything that we own is derived from natural resources on the planet one way or another. Even synthesis has to use natural resources. So on the most fundamental scientific basis, the natural resources on the planet are the most important thing. And when you look at the pollution that's happening in society, when you look at they ignore all elements of nature. So industry doesn't seem to care. Doesn't have a purpose to care. It can't afford to care about nature. Therefore, we're having mass amounts of destruction. So on a very fundamental level, we have to recognize that resources are everything. They're the ones they're the elements of the planet that help contribute to our way of life and keep our level of living and contribute to solving problems and medical conditions. Everything is derived from the planet's resources. Obviously, that's very obvious for most. When it comes to management, just on a simple level, obviously we have to take extreme care as a society, each one of us, as far as the management of the Earth's resources, because again, that is the basis of our entire existences, is the gifts that the Earth has in utilizing energy and everything else. Now, if you want to get into the governmental aspect of this, and this is where things get tricky for most people to understand, the management of the Earth's resources, as based on how it relates to human society and the operations of human society, what you begin to see is that it's sort of a self-developing type of system, to the effect that if you have a plot of land and you want to know what you can do with it, you want to examine the resources, you want to look at the topsoil to see what type of nutrients are available and what might have a stronger inclination or propensity to grow in that particular environment. So you navigate the resources, you look at it and it's there, and you decide what you can do, and the parameters become self-evident to a certain degree. As far as the planet is concerned, we can't do anything on this planet, really, as a collective group in high optimization, unless we have a full understanding of what we have and what the capacity is of each type of, say, mineral or resource or energy or a spot of geothermal energy. We have to start looking at the world as we would a small plot of land to see what we're actually capable of. So this takes this resource management idea to a new level. And again, the parameters become self-evident. So if society needs something, we don't need to have a bunch of bureaucrats sit around and decide what to do. The only reason that we have these bureaucrats now is because, A, people do not understand the scientific method, which is a natural unfolding and process. You can't have a table with two legs. It doesn't work. It has certain rules it goes by in order for the design to be effective in a particular situation. This applies to every single system that we have. So the other reason the bureaucrats exist is because of money management. That's the only reason we have government to begin with, frankly. Because if you really want to know what helps our life, it's resources and technology. I mean, I don't mean mysticism ideas and spirituality aside. Everything that we have is technology. That is our reward and our creativity. That's our divinity, is our technological abilities, our technological understanding to create things that help us, that solve problems. That is the true mechanism, is our creativity, and this is something that's been lost. And resources are obviously the fundamental cell of that. So resource management is the most important. And as far as how systems actually operate in the Venus Project-based society, he utilizes high technology and computerized systems. And again, people hear that and they say, well, that sounds very spooky to me. I've seen Terminator. I've seen Blade Runner. You know, I can't relate to that. Of course, Hollywood has depicted technology in the worst ways possible. Everything's a post-apocalyptic film with machines taking over. Machines are simply extensions of human attributes, nothing more. They have no feelings. They do whatever we decide they do. So that's the first little hurdle that people need to get over as far as this. In an automated system, a system that is set up and designed to care for the well-being of people on the fundamental level, meaning that if you need food, you have a whole system of agriculture set up at the highest optimization, no concern with money, therefore everything can be optimized to its highest degree based on the resources available in that region or that need to be brought in. And then those resources, that food, excuse me, is with machines, obviously, which is extremely easy. You get those into distribution centers or grocery stores or whatever you want to call them. And it requires very little human labor. The only real government that can possibly exist is a system of technicians that oversee the computerized systems. They don't make decisions of what's needed. The community makes these decisions, and they are simply there to supervise. And again, people will say, well, wait a minute, who are these technical elite? They're the ones that are going to corrupt. Absolute power corrupts absolutely. That's actually not true. Absolute power corrupts absolutely in a condition where corruption is rewarded. And I believe that it isn't a human propensity to say, just take somebody and put them on the ground and just beat them just because they want to see them suffer. That is a total contrivance of this sick system that we have. And the human value system is going to change, meaning that people are going to slowly not feel as threatened by each other, and people will begin to contribute to society like a child contributes, you know, with his friends, or you contribute with your friends now. You don't want money in return for your contribution to a friend's project or something like that, at least not usually. If, you know, you're surviving as it is, you contribute because you want to give and help your friends and your family. And this is the type of new worldview that will emerge. Not only will there be no jobs necessary, excuse me, no monotonous jobs. There's no reason to have people doing, I would say 85% to 90% of all jobs that are currently in existence now are absolutely vain. And they're there simply to perpetuate the need to have labor for income. People have to have a job to make money, so they have to keep making, inventing new jobs one way or another, and keep getting their wedge in the door as far as taking in money and capital through marketing and what have you. And the system just keeps repeating like this. We have to move out of this system and realize that technology is our savior. And if we utilize technology, I mean, the public has no idea how advanced technology really is at this point, how things that we consider to be, things that could never change could be so easily automated. I mean, everything is technology. Anyone who denies that isn't paying much attention. Well, think about what your life would be like, you know, or a heart patient that doesn't have his pacemaker. You know, we are technological. We are supported by technology from top to bottom, and it's time we recognize this and move forward with it as opposed to paralyzing it, which is what is happening in our current labor system. So back to the idea of who makes the decisions. The question isn't who makes the decisions. It's how are the decisions arrived at. And this is probably one of the most important points that people need to research for themselves in regards to this new idea. Because people can understand, you know, all the systems approach to society, a design of society, a system where, you know, we have such abundance created where you can walk into a grocery store and get whatever you want, never have to pay any money or fill out any forms. And you just leave with the food, and people will say, wait a minute, what if people just start taking things? Well, there's no reason to take things because there's no way to sell it. There's no reason to sell it because everybody else can go and get the abundance as well. So there's an equilibrium that will exist because the human value system will be changed from a scarcity self-preservation motivation to a giving and contributing mentality, recognizing that the more they give to society, the more that the society improves and the more that they get. This is completely reversed now. And back to my other point, the idea that people get corrupt in government will eventually fade away because there's no basis for the corruption. And even if slight corruption did exist, the awareness of the culture will be such that it could be dealt with in much more humane ways, in ways that don't require prisons and police. I would say that, you know, a simple statistical analysis of the people in prisons revealed, well, most of them, I'd say 30 to 40% are actually nonviolent drug offenders, which in and of itself is completely sick. Drug addiction is not a crime. It's an internal problem. It's a psychological issue, usually a form of escapism due to deprivation and poverty or, you know, some aberrant boredom that a person is brought into, or, of course, the need to make money, which is a general necessity in the system. So, of course, people are going to sell drugs and do what they need to do. And then the other people in prison are usually people that have petty crimes of violent nature. You know, you have a few that are just absolutely violent, that are just completely aberrant, but the great majority are people that have done what they needed to in order to survive through robbery or things like that. So once you eliminate this scarcity, once you eliminate money as the ultimate tool of deviance, which is really what it is from top to bottom at this point in time, then you see an entirely new worldview emerge and human society taking care of itself. For example, if we have a serial killer, what do you do? I mean, people have such a religious kind of retribution feeling that if a serial killer gets caught, everyone jumps up and down and wants them immediately killed, and they want to rip them apart. Well, this is ridiculous in an intelligent society. What you do when you recognize, first of all, that the serial killer isn't bad, he's a product of his aberrant conditioning, that you take him in and you examine him, you try to figure out what it is in his life that caused this. There have been a few, you know, court psychologists that have attempted to do this in the past, but they don't get very much acclaim, and they're just not recognized because of this underbreeding of religious retribution that we have in our society. You know, electric chair and the death penalty, and then the sickness carries for a long degree. And it's not that I'm against the death penalty or any of that stuff. It's that I look way beyond it, that there's no point in it. Because if you really want to understand why people commit crimes, you have to look at the behavior of what their behavior themselves and what experiences have created that behavior. So I'm jumping in a few different angles here, but the point is that we have to have confidence, and I believe this to be completely true. I think we are victims of our culture. We have to have confidence that those that could be in positions of decision-making on some degree, meaning during the transition from our current system to a new system, we have to have people organizing things until we get the system up to date technologically, where we remove 90% of the monotonous jobs that are no longer needed, where we have nanotechnology improving. I mean, you have to think about a world that could be so different. If you jump way ahead, you know, nanotechnology is such that you could have a point where distribution is no longer relevant. This might sound very science fiction to most people, but molecular restructuring through nanotechnology is on a course of development where you could, say, go on to your internet and request a particular design of chair, and it could materialize in your home. I know this sounds ridiculous for most, but think about what that eliminates as far as distribution and labor. This is the type of stuff we have to start thinking about. There is a massive future ahead of us that will change our social systems and approaches to life in ways that we can't even imagine. Human beings will behave in ways that are so different, just like the cavemen were behaving, which would be very different from us today. I mean, even in Rome, they used to feed Christians to lions. No one does stuff like that anymore. We're developing slowly. We're paralyzed by the system, but we are slowly getting into a more humane, less scarce-based society. And it's time we put the accelerator pad down on this and really start to move forward with a direction that's actually for humanity, designed for humanity, humanity recognizing that it's related to everyone else, understanding that if there is, that my personal integrity is completely related to the integrity of another man in Saudi Arabia who's living on the street. If that man is in poverty, then I am not safe. My integrity is in jeopardy because the system is so out of whack. And that's why we live within this kind of fear-based, you know, thing that's perpetuated constantly and used by the establishment, terrorism, crime. That's why on every Hollywood film, it's always crime and debauchery. These are the things that are compounded into us to keep that neuroses going because it serves the establishment. It's the ultimate form of divide and conquer. And it keeps working because it's half true and it's half imposed. So back to my original point, the governments of the future will not be governments whatsoever. As it's stated in Zeitgeist Addendum, Jacques Fresco says, and many people don't understand this because they have no frame of reference, but he says the state does nothing because there is no state. And that's the point. There isn't a state based on the definition of state that we understand today. We have to utilize technology to solve our problems. Computers can think much faster than we can. We can navigate our planet. We can see what we have. We can create an abundance. And we can have a self-generating type of ideology through the scientific method that navigates philosophically the way we orient ourselves to each other and everything else. There's an underlying emergent and symbiotic element of nature that once people understand it, all the superstitions and all of the outdated, outmoded romantic beliefs will slowly have very little validity because there's nothing tangible anymore to support them. This is the path that's been created.
Peter, do you think there's anything that's already standing in the way of us and nanotechnology that is deliberately using nanotechnology against humanity? Do you think
of
there's...
Of course.
Okay.
No, they've been using technology against us ever since technology was created. The infamous they, those that want to preserve their establishment. Obviously, there's surveillance. I'm sure they use nanotechnology for deviant means. We have to recognize this. In the end, either society is going to be taken over by technology with a small elite that are just going to abuse people, maintain their monetary system, create a form of serfdom. This is the natural monopoly. This is the world monopoly I'm talking about. But people have to stand up and say, wait a minute, I recognize technology. I know what technology is. I know what it can do. I'm not going to allow this to happen. And the people have to start making decisions for themselves. And if they don't, others are going to make the decisions for us, and it's not going to be in our advantage because of the way our current system's set up. It will only lead to more tyranny, which is why we have to really start thinking about an entirely new social structure to begin this influence, to begin changing human behavior from the outside while simultaneously hoping people that learn and have introspect will learn and have introspect and change from the inside as well. I think this awakening is happening on multiple levels. People, statistically, religion has dropped overall in its superstitious value, even though the Islamic tradition has, you know, continued its growth. There are things that are happening with people's worldviews that are becoming more unified as people learn about science. They learn about nature and how beautiful it really is. and how we are connected to it. And the more we understand these connections, the more we understand nature and reality. I mean, that is the real, the priests of our world, if I could use something as ridiculous, are really the scientists. They're the ones that have their hands in the ether. They're the ones that are looking at the molecules and looking at nature. This is the type of thing we have to start realizing as a culture. We have to start connecting to nature. And until we do that, it's just going to be chaos, destruction, and disorder. We're out of line, in other words.
Right, but so many scientists are being recruited to put their expertise toward very negative.
Absolutely, the nuclear bomb.
Right, on some level, the individual has to step in and own himself or herself and say, I will do this and not this, and that's where choice comes in. And in your film, you say we have to alter our behavior to return to the will of the people.
Sure.
And my note after that was, but we have no will. We are carbon copies and not free spirits. So on some level, we have to repossess our spirits. Right?
Sure, absolutely. No, I completely agree. That's a great point you made about that statement. That was sort of a loaded statement, you know, the will of the people, what does that really mean? I guess I think deep down people have a natural childlike inclination to really not want to be a slave to a corporate structure, that really want to be free. I think the kernels of a child in his curiosity, that imprinting, that sort of the genetics of, so to speak, of just a child, you know, they learn so fast and they don't know what the system is, so they have a natural propensity to pursue their own interests, and this is what's robbed of them. So I completely agree with you. I mean, as an adult, we all have to start internally realizing these important points.
Right, and we're upon our last little break, okay. So we'll be back in 3 minutes. You're listening to Expansion on republicbroadcasting.org, the RBN network. This is Sophia, your host, and we are concluding a very enlightening interview with Peter Joseph, creator of Zeitgeist Addendum. Listen to me, I'm about to say attention. I have to pay it. Peter, you've given us a great gift in this film, I think. Your intelligence, your articulation, the inspiration that is woven through the film. And also, I have to mention the style of the film. It's very smooth, it's beautifully created, expertly edited, and it's sold for almost nothing, which reflects your generosity. So I think you're really living what you are advocating, and you're willing to let people duplicate it. This is all very extraordinary. So I want to thank you on behalf of many people, I think, for having done all this.
Sure, yeah. Well, as Gandhi stated, you have to kind of become the change. You can't just perpetuate it and talk about it. Everyone has to, as you stated before the break, you know, people have to say no to the establishment. They have to become what they expect. I believe that the means is the end, and because there is no end. It's an emergent culmination. Everything's constantly changing and moving in some direction. So we have to become the end, so to speak. We have to be what we want to attain. So, you know, violence and things like that, you can't. There's a reason why peace protesters are met with men and riot fatigues and automatic weapons. You know, they're waiting for the people to be reduced to that level of violence because that's how the society is maintained. It's based on this assumption of us against them constantly. So, in other words, I think until people just really step up and say, I'm personally going to alter my behavior. I don't care what my family does. I don't care what my spouse does. I'm going to do this because this is the right path. The moment everyone does that, is the moment you'll see a cataclysmic change on this planet. Unfortunately, everyone is in fear. They're forced to stay in their little positions. They don't want to shake or rock the boat because they might lose their job or they might, you know, their fear of being on a terrorist watch list and all these things. And it's time we start ignoring these fear-based elements and everyone needs to just do what they think is correct and really think about that, of course, and be vulnerable to that, not be dogmatic. But if everyone did that, I think you'd see a completely different world. It's a very terrified world out there, unfortunately.
Yes, and not always to seek advantage, because we've got to step off that chessboard of seeking advantage as well. And one of the concluding statements in your film is, there's no teacher, no pupil, no master, no leader. And for us to understand is to transform what is. And that's the whole crux of what I think that film is trying to relay.
Right, yes, absolutely.
And you can't transform from learned helplessness, learned helplessness. You just can't do it. So you have to shuck that and say, okay, I'm not helpless. I'm something else, whatever that is.
Right. Yeah, the society has compounded this fear, and everyone is, you know, minimal. Everyone has to... The whole basis is to basically keep people at an inferiority type of disposition. And that's what all the advertising agencies do. Every time you see someone promote something, a product, they make it seem like you have to have it to be acceptable within the system, and therefore you're inferior if you don't. All these things are rampant. It's
Peter,
compounded. Yes.
We are ending. So
okay.
I have to say goodbye to you, but I would love to have you on again, because seem to be awfully deep and expansive and extensive. So thank you so much for doing this show with me.
Thank you, Sophia. I appreciate it.